Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Dwayne, how you doing?
I'm all right, Andy. How's it going?
I'm doing great. I just downloaded iOS 7 from my iPhone, and I'm stoked. I really enjoy the parallax view. I think that's probably one of my favorite design features. How about you? Have you downloaded it?
Yeah, I've been playing with the beta for a while, but I just got the full version for my iPad. And I got to say, I like Parallax. I like Parallax a lot, but I think I'm most excited about the toggles.
The toggles. Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. Tom Cheridar, our special guest for tonight, what's your favorite feature of iOS 7?
Man, there are just so many. I'm kind of a nut for the smaller things. The little ticks and clicks on the operating system, opening it up and not having those ugly ass swipe buttons anymore. They're gone.
It just makes
me feel like I'm $1 million, like I'm someone of importance.
We're going to talk about all that and much more tonight on The Drill Down. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
I'm Tosin Unifowaken.
And tonight we have a very special guest with us, Tom Cheridar. Tom, you used to be one of the co-hosts of The Drill Down back in the day.
Yes, I feel like it's, Andy, our time together with The Drill Down is kind of akin to that odd season of Scooby-Doo where they had the Puerto Rican kid and Thelma, but no Fred and Daphne. We kept it together.
When Scrappy-Doo was part of the team? No, I...
Yeah, like every once in a while.
I treasured the moments that you were on because you were... I felt that you were a very valuable member being the tech columnist that you are. And we miss you here on The Drill Down. So it's glad to have you back. Joining us for helping us out for tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
This week, the head of the NSA channels, Captain Kirk, is Linux the future of gaming? Twitter goes public, and now that it's conquered search, Google's next challenge is mortality itself. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. Facebook.com and Twitter.com, both at The Drill Down. Our show is on Stitcher at stitcher.com. Search for The Drill Down there. And now we're also on the Swell app, which is kind of like a Pandora for podcasts. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the week. And I wanted to talk about a couple of things that I've been playing with within the last week and the last few days. And actually, like this latest one, it was in basically today. As we talked about in the cold open, I downloaded iOS 7. Which took a while. The servers were clogged as hell, so it took a while to get the activation handshake from Apple. But once I did, downloaded it, and I've been playing with it, and it's beautiful. It looks my only complaint, initial complaint from iOS 7 is that I think the font, which is a super thin font, maybe a little bit too thin for me. I kind of like the fat font with the numbers, and you know, it's like my contacts and the other numbers that I'm looking at are just a hair, like one pixel, point too thin for me. But I'm sure it's something that I can learn to live with. I love the translucency.
I think you'll have to learn to
live with it. Yes, yes, yes. Won't have much of a choice. I just have to get a stronger prescription. Dwayne, you linked me to an article that TechCrunch published called "A Few Tricks That All the New iOS 7 Users Should Know," where they highlight some features that were not necessarily made broadly public. And some interesting things there, like for example, there's a built-in compass. I mean, I'm sorry, there's a built-in bubble level, and it's the second page of their compass. Not a lot of people know that. I thought that was an interesting feature, and one that, that once again, not a lot of people are aware of. How about you, Dwayne? What's your favorite new feature of iOS 7?
I really like the toggle situation. I use that. I mean, I'm using it on my iPad. I haven't upgraded to iOS 7 on my iPhone yet because I'm just a slow software upgrader. I will upgrade hardware the minute it comes out, but it's just the Windows guy in me. Like, I just don't trust new software until everybody else has complained about it and I know what I'm getting into. But I'll probably hook it up this weekend when I pick up the new iPhone, and I'll be giving my girlfriend my current iPhone, and she can enjoy the spoils of iOS 7 herself. But yeah, I really like the toggles. I like the idea that you can search from anywhere in there, and I think the upgrades to Siri are pretty nice. But I gotta say, those toggles, I've been missing them since iOS 3.0. When I had iOS 3, I jailbroke it because it just wasn't where it needed to be.
Uh-huh.
And SBS settings, you know, shout out to the you know, Cydia clans out there. They had that situation. They had toggles that were you were available to get from a quick swipe down with your thumb, and it was wonderful. And you know, iOS matured. I realized I could get over that for the other features and not having to worry about whether apps would work or not, or yada yada yada. And
I can finally ditch my flashlight app.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So is that, and you know, I used to have like a life hack for the flashlight. Uh-huh. I would pop open the video, like I was gonna take a video, and then I turned the flash on, and like I'd be doing all that stuff. But yeah, so I think it's a nice upgrade for anyone who's been tired of it. I was talking to my boss today, and she said, I don't understand why they have to change everything. It looks like there's no depth. I like the old way, and I'm like, well, the old way. If you're like a tech person, and you're looking at iOS 7 right now, it's kind of like walking into your grandparents' like living room and seeing that couch with the plastic on it,
the wood paneling.
Exactly, it's got this late 60s, early 70s feeling to it, and that's in large part because the people who like ran iOS 7 Forrestal, you know, he was a kid in the late 60s, early 70s, and he really wanted to make sure that in the beginning of this paradigm, people really understood what was going on. A calendar is going to look like a calendar in the real world.
Skeuomorphism.
And that skeuomorphism, it played a big role in indicating. Actually, before skeuomorphism, there was just a tactile feeling designed to help acclimate people. Skeuomorphism started showing up where leather started showing up in 2010 when the iPad came out and the app had leather in it. That's where skeuomorphism showed up. But from 2007 to 2010, it was just reminders and indications of what the world was like.
Right.
And in 2010, the iPad shows up, and there's the leather, and then there's all this other stuff.
The epitome of that was that with the podcast app, they had a reel-to-reel tape display, and reel-to-reel has been obsolete for, you know, 20 years now.
And they were using I really like that, especially because tape storage is still in vogue for a lot of hardcore storage companies.
It's classy.
Yeah, it was classy. I actually preferred that aspect of that app a lot. So I'm gonna miss that stuff. But you know, it's still hanging out on my iPhone 3GS where it'll stay.
Sure. We all must move on. Speaking of moving on, a couple of other things that I've been playing with. I'm a little late to the game on this one, but I finally picked up The Last of Us, which is Naughty Dog's. I don't want to say zombie. Post-apocalyptic, infected person story. And I'd heard tons about this. It had gotten all sorts of rave reviews. And basically, I had been reluctant to pick it up because it was just. I usually don't get new games like the moment they come out because they're a little too pricey for me, so I wait a little while. And this one I picked up used, The Last of Us, and which was a good deal. I have to say, though, I don't know if anybody else here has played The Last of Us, but the opening is, without giving any spoilers away, the opening is an emotional sledgehammer, kind of in the same way that the first 10 minutes of the movie Up is. Like, if you're not ready for it, especially if you're a parent, it will devastate you. And in fact, I had to turn the game off, and I haven't picked it up since, because it was just so emotionally devastating. But it gives me just a slightest hint as to what I have to look forward to playing the rest of the game.
Wow, that's really impressive that they can get to such an emotional level within the game. And that's really another, you know, that really speaks to Naughty Dog and what yep. they've been able to accomplish. I do have the game. Still haven't tried it. It's wrapped on my floor just because I've been so busy of late. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's definitely one. I highly recommend it. Another one that I picked up, and this one, once again, I have to give the proviso here that I don't usually get games first day, but I had enough Amazon credit card points.
Or cookies.
that this was actually a free purchase for me. But I got GTA 5. And apparently so did a number of other people, because it made Take-Two announced that it made $800 million in sales worldwide within the first 24 hours of the sale, the highest first day retail sales of
any
title.
That's gotta be a brand new rating. Yeah. That's I mean, that doesn't include pre-orders. That includes just first day sales.
Yep. Yep.
That is wow! That really blows the shit out of Halo, huh?
Yeah. Well, they say it's the highest first day retail sales of any title in the history of the company and of the GTA series. I don't know if it beats all records.
Yeah, I think there's some Call of Duty games in there
Call of Duty or some one of the other. What's the other one? It's not Call of Duty.
Battlefield.
Yeah, one of those two did something crazy, like almost $1 billion or something like that a while ago. But yeah, I mean, that's still very impressive. It also goes to show that the content generators are still king, right? Yeah. When it comes to, consoles mm-hmm. And other interactive content, games, apps, that kind of thing, you're going to see these guys always take the money home, because the platforms on sure. which they're producing this stuff is designed to fight piracy on a crazy level. And the immediacy and the necessariness of getting this content is such that the vast majority of buyers purchase within the first 6 months before any sort of black market version of the stuff is available. So it's pretty impressive.
Also demonstrates the power of gaming in general, the gaming community, in that I cannot fathom the biggest blockbuster movie that I can even imagine having an $800 million opening weekend.
Well, that's also because, again, interactive content is far more immersive, and the fan base of these kinds of games is far more loyal and far more focused than if the Titanic comes out. Titanic was a huge movie, and Avatar was a huge movie. But the fact is, both of them spoke to very different audiences. If you're a complete sci-fi geek, you're going to see Avatar. You may not see Titanic. If you're a drama lover, you're going to see Titanic. You may not see Avatar. But with the gaming, with the gaming group, you're always going to see it. You're always ready for it. And it's tied to the technology, so you're excited for it when it's brand new.
I also have to say that I haven't played with this much. I've only got about a half an hour into it since it just came out yesterday as we're recording here. I played about a half an hour, and it's amazing, so far. Like there's a prologue, which you kind of have to play through in a structured way. And then there is another sort of task, a couple of other tasks that you have to play to sort of get yourself acclimated to other skills. And then they as with most GTA games, now they kind of let you loose to accomplish the skills in a freeform way. And that's where I'm at now. Like, I'm at just at the point where, as the character, one of the three characters, Franklin, I'm sort of loose on the city to explore and fulfill the tasks in whatever way I want to. And I've been driving around the city, sort of getting a feel for it, driving up and down the mountains and crashing my car and getting killed a couple times, just to get the feel of the area and the mechanics. And it's pretty impressive so far. I'm sure I'll fill you guys in as I get deeper into the game, how it's playing. Dwayne, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
Well, the snowboarding season's coming up. It's mid-September, and you really start to start right. You really start to get on the mountain in late November. And I've been checking out some new technology by Zeal and a company called Recon that makes a device called the Mod Live Module. Basically, it's a pair of ski goggles, and a bunch of people make these types of ski goggles. Smith makes one, Zeal makes one, a couple other guys, and they're called Recon Mod Live Ready, which means you can insert a module into the lower right-hand corner of it, and it's a little tiny screen connected to basically what seems to be either an Android. I think it's like an old version of Android-powered mini computer, and that has Bluetooth and a whole bunch of other features. And what it does is it allows you to check out your altitude, your speed, and a couple other stats about yourself. And if you've purchased a Contour camera, any of the newer Contour cameras that support Bluetooth, you can actually Bluetooth into the camera from mm-hmm. your goggle situation. And when you look down in your goggles, you'll be able to see, when you activate it, you'll be able to see what's on your helmet cam. So when it comes to filming one of your friends, there's none more of that like, okay, where is the camera? Let's hope I get the shot, whatever. And for a person who, is out there and, you're in mittens and all that other stuff, it's an amazing feature that allows you to kind of just get things going quickly without having to take off a lot of gear, put a lot of gear on. And it makes sure that all your shots are pretty tight. Battery lasts about 8 hours, which is exactly what you need for a day of snowboarding. And for what it is, it's pretty exciting. Now, the catch is it's really expensive. For the Zeal version of the goggles, it's about $650. And for the Smith version, it's like $500-something. And then, if you want like a Contour camera to go on top of that, you're spending another $200-$300. Unless you want the high-end one, which is $400. So you can legitimately begin spending a whole bunch of money on these devices today. Mm-hmm. But it's cool because skiing is something that I've been drove me to the whole quantified self movement, between my Fitbit and Ski Tracks apps and other apps. So I'm excited for like what the A7 can bring to the skiing apps. I'm excited for this kind of functionality in these goggles and I was just checking them out to see what they're all about before I actually think about plunking down cash on them or whatever.
I'm sorry, what's it called again? Z-Optics?
Zeal Optics.
They're Zeal basic. Optics.
Yeah, they make the goggle that's quote-unquote ready for the module. So does Smith Optics and a couple other optical companies make goggles that are ready. And Zeal is cool because unlike so many others, all of their technology, all of their like goggles and so on, they're made out of plant resin rather than plastic.
Uh-huh.
Everything is super eco-friendly, and they're like cradle-to-cradle kind of company. So they're just another artisanal Boulder startup. They think about everything. So
cool.
It's pretty good.
Tosin, now the company that you work for had a little bit of an announcement this week. And that's what you're going to talk about on what we're playing with.
Sure. So yesterday I actually spent a majority of the day at our company conference called Boxworks. And really what Boxworks is it's a convention not only to discuss what's changing with Box the product, but also to kind of gather innovators and people in the technology space and exchange ideas as well as just hear stories and discuss what's going on in terms of the industry as well as just in terms of technology. So we had people speaking like Malcolm Gladwell, who just amazing speaker. Really, if you ever get a chance to see him or read any of his books, I would definitely suggest doing so.
I've read all of his books so far.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Great.
He has a new one coming out,
which he discussed. I think it's called David versus Goliath or something like that in terms of the title. Yeah, so definitely recommend checking that. Also, I know we've talked about the Innovator's Dilemma. Nicholas Carr was there, and he also spoke too. But in terms of some of the announcements that we had as a company, I know a lot of people have been talking about one of the things we've released called Box Notes. And
yeah,
did any of you guys hear about Box Notes?
I did. The articles that I've read compare it to Google Documents.
Yeah, so to a certain extent, it's similar, but to a certain extent, it's a little different. And so the way we've been using it internally for a while now, and the way I see it, it's really like a current, in its current iteration, of a lightweight note taker, really to allow the fostering of collaboration. Because in general, what we hope to be as an organization is the your content layer. Well, now that you have content there, you need to be able to have apps and other methods of manipulating and working with it. So that's where Box Notes fits in, just a very slim method of getting ideas down, maybe working collaboratively with other people. A way my colleague and I usually use it is when we go to conferences or go on sites, we'll open up a Box Note and we'll be collaborating together, you know, having the same security permissions that we already have in Box. So I think it's a pretty fun feature to have, and it's something that's, you know, if you're interested in beta, you can sign up, but it will be coming for everyone. So I think on one realm, it is like Google Docs. It mm-hmm. is sort of like Evernote, but it's more lightweight. It's also collaborative, and it's built as part of the Box platform.
All right, let's get into some of our headlines for tonight. The National Security Agency, the NSA, widely monitors international payments, banking, and credit card transactions, according to a new document seen by Der Spiegel. The information acquired by NSA contractor and whistleblower Edward Snowden, again, this is our NSA watch portion of the show, apparently, show that the spying is conducted by a branch called Follow the Money. The collected information then flows into NSA's own financial data bank called TrackFin, or Track Finances, which in 2011 contained 180 million records, and 84% of that data is from credit card transactions. So essentially the bottom line is, if you're sending payments overseas, it's very likely that the NSA is tracking that payment one way or the other. The intent, of course, is to track payments that might be associated with terrorist activities, but they're collecting, you know, everyone's transactions, international money transactions.
Can they use that data for something useful, like figuring out what consumers are buying, what kind of trends need to happen, helping out our economic plan? Or can they just at least, at the very least, tell me what I'm buying overseas? Because I look at my credit card statement sometimes and I'm like, oh shit, I bought that? Where is that? I'm sure my girlfriend would love to know what I'm buying overseas, and they can just hook her up with that kind of access.
See,
that'd
Dwayne,
be great.
I think you're onto something. I think the NSA needs to
They need to productize this.
Yes,
shit.
Absolutely.
That's what I mean. If you can't beat them, join them. Right? They just need to productize it and just give us access to this wonderful data, the aggregated trends.
Yeah.
You know, give those to advertisers. Just the trends, not the actual individual data, but you know what's going on. Just let that data just sit there and roll, and the NSA and the government could really start taking in some serious cash, and maybe it'll help us with this whole, you know, economy thing.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's the key is to sell that data. Now that they've got it, you know, quit being so covert about it. Just admit that you've got it. And now here it is. Here's the data. Here's the fire hose of data. You want to buy it? We'll sell it to you. And we'll boost.
Just the trends. You can just sell like reports based on trends. Consumers in this area are doing this. Consumers in that area are doing this. Lots of phone calls internationally come over here. Like the demographic data, the behavioral data alone, aggregated, is worth a fortune. And then you tie that in with the fact that they've got some crazy-ass hardware and storage that's able to manage and understand this data. And, you know, people would license that shit. So I just feel like there's a lot here that as a capitalist, the government, frankly, isn't taking advantage of. And I hate to make light of a very serious like civil liberty situation. But really, there could be a lot of money made out of this.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Speaking of crazy ass and the NSA, it's been previously reported that the mentality of NSA Chief General Keith Alexander is captured by his motto, collect it all. But perhaps an even more disturbing and revealing vignette into the spy chief's mind comes from a new foreign policy article describing what the journal calls his all-out barely legal drive to build the ultimate spy machine. The article describes how even his NSA peers see him as a cowboy willing to play fast and loose with legal limits in order to construct a system of ubiquitous surveillance. But the personality driving all of this is perhaps best captured by this one passage highlighted by PBS's NewsHour in a post entitled NSA Director Modeled War Room After Star Trek's Enterprise. The room was christened as part of the Information Dominance Center. And here's a quote. When he was running the Army's Intelligence and Security Command, Alexander brought many of his future allies down to Fort Belvoir for a tour of his base of operations, a facility known as the Information Dominance Center. It had been designed by a Hollywood set designer to mimic the bridge of the Starship Enterprise from Star Trek, complete with chrome panels, computer stations, a huge TV monitor on the forward wall, and doors that made a whoosh sound when they slid open and closed. Lawmakers and other important officials took turns sitting in the leather captain's chair in the center of the room and watched as Alexander, a lover of science fiction movies, showed off his data tools on the big screen. Everyone wanted to sit in the chair at least once to pretend he was Jean-Luc Picard, said a retired officer in charge of VIP visits. So
why can't he just go to Dragon Con like the rest of us? Save us some money. It's not that expensive, you know? It's probably
where it does get a little weird.
Fourth.
Because
of Comic-Con, and you know, you can actually meet Patrick Stewart, dude.
Because
he wants to be Patrick Stewart, and that's where it gets a little annoying. Stuff, the government is like spending money on these services,
right,
whatever, but
right.
Spending money on a set for Star Trek: The Next Generation, and that set is weird too, right? It's like a death machine cloaked as an exploratory vessel that has a living room as its bridge, like the wood, the carpet. Does anyone else not feel the whole 80s split level home thing whenever they watch?
Yeah, for sure.
What I find hilarious is that this isn't even the first time the branch of the government has like grossly wasted money with a Star Wars parody. Like the IRS also did this. They made like that whole like tutorial video based on The Next Generation. And so I'm sitting here and I'm like, okay, so we've got these huge like wastes of money that are basically shoddy imitations of the Next Generations. Why is funding NASA even an issue, man? Like,
yeah, I know. This is ridiculous. NASA actually gets shit done. And you think that these actors, not when I say actors, I mean the actual people who are like doing the work of the NSA. You'd think that they would like be really happy with the very idea of a really tight NASA, because they love the show, they love what's possible. You think they'd be behind it? You think there'd be a lot of political will behind NASA getting whatever it wants in order to do its job?
Yeah. There's actually some progress made toward the public good there too, as opposed to, you know, designing your office to look like Star Trek. But there are pictures online in the link that we will have in the show notes. It's pretty phenomenal, actually. I don't know whether to be impressed or appalled, but we'll leave it at that. Moving on here. Gabe Newell, the co-founder and managing director of Valve, said this week, speaking at LinuxCon in New Orleans, that Linux is the future of gaming, despite its current minuscule share of the market. It feels a bit funny coming here and telling you guys that Linux and open source are the future of gaming, Newell said. It's sort of like going to Rome and teaching Catholicism to the Pope. Valve brought Steam to Linux in February, and the platform now has 198 games. Newell has previously promised to unveil a Linux-based Steam box to compete against living room game consoles sometime this year, and his company has updated the Steam software to work better on TVs. While he didn't specifically mention the Steam box, he hinted at an announcement coming in the next week. He said, next week we're going to be rolling out more information about how we get there and what are the hardware opportunities we see for bringing Linux into the living room. Newell has previously complained about Windows 8 being a catastrophe for everyone in the PC space. And he reiterated those concerns at LinuxCon, saying closed platforms are going to lose to open ones that allow innovation. What do you guys think? Is Linux the future of gaming?
Well, here's a question for you. You bought, was it an Ouya? Is that the name of that console?
Yes.
So
and a game stick as well. Well, that's a good question. I haven't touched it in a while, but the problem with the Ouya is that isn't the device itself. Well, part of the problem is that the device is running a very low power, essentially a mobile phone chip. And the other problem is that the developers that they've licensed with are not these big name developers. Like they had like the power of a Steam behind of a Valve software behind it. That would be we'd be talking about a different story altogether. And in fact, another project that I backed, GameStick, supposedly has some better developers associated with it, and they're going to have supposedly regular features such as Netflix and the ones that you would find on a lot of the set-top boxes now, like Roku, are going to be available via the game stick. So
yeah, I guess for me, it's just I'm trying to see where the well, apart from having a different OS, where is that real innovation that is going to capture the existing markets? What is going to cause someone on, say, an Xbox or a PlayStation to switch over? Like I can see how it may be easier in like a potentially easier in a PC market, right?
Yeah,
you're not having to upgrade your video card, your computer on a more regular basis. You have a dedicated box which easily hooks up to your TV. But if we're really looking at, you know, the future of gaming, we need to also keep in mind the other big players in that field. And I guess I'm trying to see how they differentiate themselves. And, you know, is it indie or is it, you know?
What if Gabe Newell were to say that Half-Life 3 was an exclusive on Linux?
Well, that's what he'd need. I think what Tosin's alluding to is the fact that you look at closed systems versus open systems, right? The big joke about Google's Android is that it's clopen. There's certain things about it that are open. There are plenty of things about it that are closed, right? And then you look at Apple's system, which is completely closed, and it's wildly successful, incredibly popular. It may not have as many handsets out there, but by every metric we can see, the customer base spends more money, and people are making more revenue off of it. Is a closed system a bad thing? No. Is a closed system that doesn't allow for freedom and innovation a bad thing? Yes. Apple, when they had their September 10th event, they were talking about games. We all know that the iPhone is a dynamic game platform for many. Epic, you know, the Epic Citadel game that's coming out of the guys who've made all of the Unreal games and so on. Those guys are using OpenGLES, which is an open architecture, open language, whatever, and they've hitched their cart to Apple devices, because just like a console, it's a consistent device. I think the biggest thing for game developers is probably the consistency of the device and the support they get for the device. And that's going to matter more than open or closed. You get a good device with good hardware that has potential, you're going to do well. That's why Sony and Microsoft were able to sit back for 7 years, 8 years with these you know, seventh generation devices.
That's a good point.
Like you need a device that allows for the developers to that has legs and allows the developers to continually refine their work. And now with these new devices, you know, I could see them lasting for the next 7 years at least. If what we're seeing with 256 megabytes of RAM can be worked on for the next several years with 8 gigabytes of RAM and processors that kick the living shit out of the current ones. Then, I mean, you know, the possibilities are endless. It's really all about the support the developers get. Now, can Sony and Microsoft pivot so that they allow more indie developers to show up? I mean, I think Sony's proven it already has. Microsoft has yet to really show that. But that's really what I think we're seeing here. We're seeing a world in which you don't need super openness in order to win, as long as the hardware is consistent and the software is from an environment that supports the developer.
Yeah, I think that's where, you know, we've seen that's where both Sony and Microsoft are moving towards with the next generation consoles of theirs. It's more unified system that allows developers not to fight the console, but just work in an environment that they're familiar with. Okay, let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the audiobook that I'd like to talk about this week is called The Most Human Human, What Talking with Computers Teaches Us About What It Means to Be Alive by Brian Christian. I heard about this book on NPR. I believe it was NPR. It might have been the other one. It was a program called... I'm blanking on the name of the program, too. But it was they talked about... It's basically an exploration into the state-of-the-art of artificial intelligence. It's an exploration of the ways in which computers are reshaping our ideas of what it means to be human. Its starting point is the annual Turing test, which pits artificial intelligence programs against people to determine if computers can think. The author's quest to be deemed more human than a computer opens a window into our own nature, interweaving modern phenomenon like customer service chatbots and men using program dialogue to pick up women in bars with insights from fields as diverse as chess, psychiatry, and the law. Brian Christian examines the philosophical, biological, and moral issues raised by the Turing test. The article on NPR talked about this this classic AI program called ELIZA, which was one of the very first AI programs out there. And I distinctly remember playing with ELIZA and being sort of in awe of its seemed intelligence. In any case, to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, all you need to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it and you still get to keep the audiobook for free. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Twitter files for IPO and Google wants to cancel death. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Maybe. Soaks you to the bone. Maybe I just wanna fly, wanna live but don't wanna die. Maybe I just wanna breathe. Maybe I just don't believe. Maybe you're the same as me. We see things I'll never see. You and I are gonna live forever. I said maybe.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin, and we have with us this week our guest, Tom Cheridar. And Tom, I'm sorry I didn't mention when we first introduced you where you're from the people who have not are not familiar with you. You're from VentureBeat.
Antarctica. Yes. Yes, I'm from VentureBeat.
And you do regular reporting for them, and fine job it is as well. And in fact, in just a second, we're going to talk about one of the articles that you've recently reported on. But first, Twitter, the 200 million user microblogging service, has filed for its initial IPO. Fittingly, the only public acknowledgement came in the form of a simple tweet, which says, we've confidentially submitted an S-1 to the SEC for a planned IPO. This tweet does not constitute an offer of any securities for sale. For Twitter's early investors and employees, an IPO would offer the payday many were waiting for. Dick Costolo, who's now the company's CEO, could see a initial investment of $25,000 grow to more than $10 million. Ev Williams, a co-founder of the company, who remains its largest shareholder, will almost certainly become a billionaire. Still, Twitter may yet hit choppy waters. Its short message format does not appeal to everyone. If it fails to add large numbers of new users, it may be perceived as a niche player. In fact, there are signs that the company isn't adding users at the pace that it had expected. If Wall Street has the same concern, it could be a problem for the IPO. Last December, Twitter announced that it had more than 200 million active users. A few months later, Dick Costolo told employees he expected to get to 400 million by the end of 2013, and sources say that Twitter now has 240 million users, which means it's added fewer than 4.5 million users in a month in 2013. Is this going to be a problem for Twitter's IPO? And does Twitter have, with that having been said, does Twitter have the legs that, say, a Facebook has had? And keep in mind, Facebook also had a troubled IPO, but I think it's on its way towards, you know, steady
growth. It's profitable now.
Yes.
Like, the thing about Facebook is it was the first time that this type of company at a huge scale IPO. There was a lot of expectation.
Yeah.
And
huge.
Almost. There was huge. Yeah, there was mammoth expectation. Let's call it that. But in the end, the guys who work for Facebook, the guys who put the blood, sweat, tears, and energy into Facebook, they all made a chunk of money. They all made a lot of money, and they were all okay. When it came to the Wall Street guys and the investors who wanted to cash in on Facebook's success, those guys didn't make so much money because it was unclear Facebook's profit, its outlook, all those things that traditional investors want to know about a company that, frankly, is in a market that didn't exist 10 years ago. And it wasn't as simple as search, which had been proven with Google. So Facebook coming out was one of those things that kind of shocked the market into reality. And I think there's going to be a lot less hyper-speculation when it comes to Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's also really interesting because you've seen how the market is really changing and shifting in terms of, or at least that's my perception here in Silicon Valley, where a lot of the articles which I've been reading these days are really all about how a lot of the investors are looking more towards, you know, enterprise products because they can guarantee financial gain rather than consumer, and it's just seems somewhat in flux in terms of where people are willing to put their money on. But, you know, Twitter does have a solid user base. The question is really more along the lines of how they plan to generate even more revenue once they go public. And, you know, I guess Twitter does have the great thing that Twitter does have going for it is, hey, you can message a lot of people instantaneously and keep them attracted and abreast of various things. So how they can do this in a more, well, continually being a sort of seamless, low-key method rather than something that, you know, detracts from their platform and causes people to switch to other things.
Well, it also has all the youth growth too. So a lot, like, while Facebook is growing between, like, ages, most rapidly between the ages of, like, 28 and, like, 39, I last read, Twitter's growth is in people who are much younger than that, decade younger than that. So there's a lot of stuff there.
Twitter's not the only app to watch for growth now. Now, Tom, you've reported recently on Pandora, who Pandora's making some interesting moves financially.
They are. They're actually. They're doing quite a bit. You know, they're not talking IPO. They did.
No.
They're public. But they did do something interesting the other day, which was they announced a huge common stock sale that could raise like almost three times as much as what they raised in their initial IPO back in 2011. So it's, we're talking at the very peak, if they sell everything and there's demand, and it's at the share price that they expect it to be, it'll be like upwards of almost $300 million. So that's a lot of money. And they didn't really specify what they were going to do with it. And on top of all of this, they're running all over the place. They just hired a new CEO. It's a guy from Microsoft, who he sold his company for like billions of dollars, and his background is in advertising, which may, you know, that may seem like a odd choice for Pandora, but
they're all ad supported, so this is what it's all about.
Well, yeah, they've even said they don't want to be a Spotify. In fact, I was in an interview with Pandora's CTO.
Yeah,
he actually told me, like, we were fine with Spotify. We look at them as kind of like the record store to us still being the radio.
Sure.
And you know, I think it's really true if you really think and click on it. They're not really competing with anyone. They're not worried about Apple iTunes. Like, honestly, like, it has really very little to do with them, because they're not in the business of competing with other streaming music stations.
But they are when it comes to iTunes Radio. iTunes Radio works effectively just like Pandora, and it's built into iOS. It doesn't you can't choose specific songs in iTunes Radio. It's stations. It has ads that come straight through. Its curation is done not by an algorithm, which is a big complaint for Pandora users, but by an algorithm in conjunction with human beings, not unlike Songza, but still, like, this idea that we're gonna have PDs, your program directors from radio stations, join us and help us figure out exactly what we should be playing on the radio. And then they've got the data. They've got everyone's iTunes purchases for the last 11 years, and they're using that to help figure out what you want to hear. If you've bought an album on iTunes, they're going to assume a couple things, like you may like this artist, and we're going to like get some lookalike artists, and we're going to begin to put them together. So I wouldn't underestimate Apple's ability to steal and, you know, step into Pandora's face in terms of the radio.
I don't whatsoever at all. But here's the big sell that everybody really kind of glosses over. The reason why Pandora is not really scared of Apple or Google or Slacker or any of these other is, number one, they are top dog by a very large margin. Number two, look at where they're making their money. Apple is not making their money off of iTunes Radio. In fact, people said the same thing with iAds, and where has that gone? Seriously take on Google the way that they said. They're not an ad company. They don't really make their money. That's an add-on for them, for people to stick around iTunes and Apple's products and Apple's services instead of going off and venturing into, you know, newer and different and things that may basically make Apple lose its edge in iTunes. And iTunes is its moneymaker.
But iTunes wasn't always part of its future.
iTunes helps sell iPhones and iPads and all of that. I mean, it's right now it's a package deal, but it's slowly migrating away from that, and they want to bring it back. So that's really, if you look at it, obviously they're not doing this, in creating a service just to lose money. They want to make money off of it, but that's not their goal. For Pandora, that's all they got. And if you look at how they're getting it, they're going after terrestrial radio stations, which suck. But guess what? Mm-hmm. They make, like, I think it's like 90% of all advertising revenue, like, sold, period, comes from old school terrestrial radio. Pandora accounts for like 7% of that.
TV is
no,
TV.
It absolutely is.
Well, for
radio. Not for audio ads.
Audio ads. Yeah, that goes to traditional radio. Yeah, that's true. $16 billion market. That's what that is.
Just that. Yeah, just that that sector, and it's a very lucrative market. I mean, like, everybody's listened to the radio lately. Like, it's not good. It's not getting better. It's only gotten
worse.
There
I want to stop you. There I want to stop you, because when you talk to when you begin to look at the numbers for instance, Clear Channel. Clear Channel's CEO looks at what he has, and from his perspective, he's got 180 million active users on his stations and through iHeartRadio. So that dwarfs Pandora's 70 million users. Now,
there's a lot of room for Pandora to grow.
Right, it does mean a lot of room for Pandora to grow. But let's talk a little bit more about the fact that when it comes to traditional radio, you know, 90% of audio listening continues to happen through traditional radio. Even though the adoption of smartphones is big, people aren't hopping on Pandora in the same way that they're able to quickly tune into the radio because it's in the cars. Now, is Pandora moving into cars? Absolutely. But satellite's been in cars for years. And because I guess if it's – I would say because of its cost, people haven't adopted it. With Pandora, you know, your vehicle has to have wireless connectivity, or it has to have Bluetooth. That's coming on mainstream, but it hasn't gotten there yet. Now with Apple, the big thing is just like iTunes, you said, is a reason to keep people around. It started that way, but now iTunes is a significant moneymaker for Apple. It makes serious money, and Apple's not playing a short game. They're playing a long one. Mm-hmm. So when Apple begins to look at this space, they're like, look, we've sold music. And we look around and we see all these people who are like, you know, the Rhapsody idea has been brought to fruition by the likes of the Pandoras and the Spotifys and the RDOs and the Mogs and all these other guys. And we can do that. We may not be able to do it just like everything Apple does. We're not going to make it the best out the gate, but we're certainly going to make it compelling, and we're going to use it to keep people sticking around.
Well, you've basically,
and over time,
talking...
but I'm saying over time, they tend to insidiously sneak in on mobile, just like how Microsoft snuck in on desktops and snuck in on things like browsers and email and so on and so forth. When you look at the power of iTunes right now, in order to move the market, the playable market. You know, iTunes sales are put up there with Billboard sales. Who ever thought that was going to happen? So I think that we can't – I think if we look back in a year when there's a discussion, when Tim Cook sits up and he says, iTunes radio is a new thing we brought in just a year. And in just 1 year we have – and he starts throwing out numbers. I think this conversation is going to be one we're going to have to look back to see if we looked at Apple's ability to grow a market – and to steal the lunch of others, frankly, as something serious, and I think it is.
Here's what it is. You're talking. I don't doubt that all of those scenarios could play out. But what I'm hearing is that like you're assuming Apple is infallible and is going to.
I
take
am not
this
assuming that they're infallible.
By this bull by the horns and reel them in, and they may they may do that, but I'm not. What I'm really looking at is.
Their track record.
I'm not looking at Apple's business for what they're doing. If you look at what Pandora is doing, they're fundamentally their business.
Their core
is not what they're not like. It's not tied to Apple. It's not Apple like eating their lunch. It's more or less it's Pandora saying we want to eat old school radio's lunch because they make actually a lot of money and we think we can do it better and we can more efficiently. Like of all radio combined, Pandora accounts for 7% of all radio listening, like everything online, off, like terrestrial, everything. And like all the other radio stations right now, like all of them combined, doing all of them are like maybe 1%, maybe. So it's like if they're 7% and they're showing revenue returns and they're doing well going into these local markets. Figuring out how to basically build the business model like they were an old school radio station, but with a really cool product that makes sense that people actually want to go to. And if they can duplicate that and grow that 7% to like even 20%, then they're a successful business. And it doesn't matter how often Apple, or how much Apple like swallows. Like there's still plenty of room to grow for both of them. And
when it comes to what Apple's doing. Terrestrial radio is going to have more problems than Pandora will, because Apple will introduce people who haven't jumped into Pandora to this model. And frankly, when it comes to radio. The labels have looked at radio, you know, traditionally they were like they had to pay into it, it was payola, then that got shut down. And looked at radio as a promotional tool for people buying their music. Now they realize that with Spotify and RDO and these guys, every time there's a spin they get played, but on radio it's all free. They're not paying, they're not getting paid anything for radio. So
they just don't pay the same kind of license, like the per play license.
They're paying something, but it's when you're a radio exec and you're looking at how the money is made and you look at the way terrestrial radio is being worked, it comes across as they're getting a lot of shit, a lot of my copyrighted information for free. And Apple is attacking that model fundamentally before and instead of going after Pandora. Will there be some attrition from Pandora? No, I think actually just like normal radio, you don't listen to one station. Because you can get Pandora for free and because you can get iTunes Radio for free, I think people are going to move back and forth between them. I don't think there's going to be a straight up, hey, I only listen to Pandora. Hey, I only listen to Apple. But I do think that over time, we've seen Apple steal markets. People giggled at the first iPhone. Look where they are today. People giggled at the idea of iTunes. The iPod didn't have the highest audio quality. All this stuff that people say, oh, they're not, it's not good. The thing is, a lot of people don't care how good it is. They just care that it's this company that they love. What I'm saying is that I think that Pandora is doing well. And I think they're solid. And you don't make $300 million off of a sale of stock for not having a good product. I think we all agree that that's there. I would just say that when we're looking at it, we need to just contemplate what Apple's been able to do in the past when entering into markets. And to realize that, you know, just like how in the watch market people wear multiple watches who are watch people, in the radio market they're going to do the same thing. So while terrestrial radio is going to have to keep their eyes open, I think they'll be around for a bit, but I think that we have to look at what Apple's doing, because I think it is going to be disruptive.
I think for sure any time that Apple decides to get into a market that was previously dominated by another company, it's going to be a interesting development to watch, and we're going to need to watch how Pandora and iTunes Radio move forward from this point on.
We've seen Apple fail in plenty of ways. We've seen Apple fail Tom was saying this on iAd. We've seen them fail on Maps.
iCloud kind of sucks.
They've got to retool iCloud. They've already done it. If you're on a Windows computer, they're all like native apps that pop up. They seem like
pretty much all of their like social efforts have failed.
Yes, every single social effort failed.
Doing great with their own document suite program. Like, they're not bad, but they're not great. You know,
they just started giving it away for free.
Yeah, exactly. Because they were like, "Well, shit."
Exactly.
So you know, they don't.
They're not infallible. Yes.
Speaking of areas where Apple is moving into places where other companies had previously dominated, one of my all-time favorite apps for Apple for iOS was Bump, which is an app that basically allows you to physically tap phones together to share contact information and more. Apple recently dropped a bomb on Bump by announcing a new feature for iOS 7 called AirDrop that would make sharing files between nearby phones a native feature. So you would think this would be the end of Bump's story. Well, Bump has recently been acquired by Google, and we're not entirely sure what Google's plan is for Bump, but surely Google would have seen the signs, the writing on the wall with AirDrop, and would have known better than to purchase a company that was on its way out. So the question is, what is it that Google sees in Bump that it wants to move forward with?
I hate Bump.
You know what? I used to use Bump a long time ago, and it was really useful back in the day. But I find like now, moving forward, being able to share contacts has become a more simplistic thing on various devices. But I think one of the areas that Bump definitely excelled in was the ability to leverage it on multiple devices, and so not just iOS. Sure. And I believe Bump also. Didn't Bump also acquire another company called Flock?
That's right. That's right. And that's some of the speculation is that Flock is a collaborative photo sharing app. And some of the speculation that I've heard is that Google is looking – actually acquired Bump for Flock to turn Flock into part of Google+. as a way to simultaneously compete with Facebook's and Dropbox's photo sharing and photo saving services.
I just never like. I mean, even when PayPal put the bump functionality in there, the idea that I've got to like tap anything against you or just shake something. Maybe it's because I have arthritis in my wrists. Right, I don't know. Right. I've never enjoyed the idea.
It was a cute interface for something.
In 2008, it was so interesting that you could use the accelerometer of your phone in order to like transfer contact, whatever. But what Google's going to offer Bump is the ability for it to be integrated on an OS level, just like how Samsung's got their situation with the hey, tap the phone to share the picture or whatever on their in the skin of their version of Android's level. So Bump wins because of that here. Don't think that Bump was relevant. After the App Store got so powerful and there were so many apps out there, it's one of those apps you use every once in a while, so you'd have to go find it and then you do the Bump thing. When it's on the OS level, like how AirDrop is on the OS level, it suddenly becomes far more compelling than it had in the past. So I think there's something to this merger. This acquisition rather. I just have to say that I haven't been compelled to use Bump in literally years because I think the functionality of having to like touch people's stuff is silly. I should be able to see who's around and just beam into their phone.
Right.
I mean, I almost would prefer an IR receiver. Even though that's
you
tech
guys
heresy.
Ever seen Bump go horribly wrong?
No.
You start sharing nasty pictures or something?
No. I mean, like people are all excited. They're like, "Let's Bump!" Drop their phone, smash it everywhere.
Oh, so I have seen that. Yes.
Three times back in the day.
Yes.
Like, when it first got it, and it wasn't like people were like, "Yeah, power slam, fist bump." It was just like pretty casual, and look at that, you're out $400.
Yeah, that was the drawback to the whimsy of the interface. All right, moving on. Speaking of Google announced this week that it's launching Calico, a new company that will focus on health and aging in particular. The independent firm will be run by Arthur Levinson, former CEO of biotech pioneer Genentech, who will also be an investor. Levinson, who began his career as a scientist and a PhD in biochemistry, plans to remain in his current roles as the board of directors for both Genentech and Apple, a position he took over after Steve Jobs died in 2011. In other words, the company behind YouTube and Google Plus is gearing up to seriously attempt to extend the human lifespan. It's interesting. Time Magazine's got a write-up on this, and they have this great quote in here. They say, "It's worth pointing out that there's no other company in Silicon Valley that could plausibly make such an announcement. Smaller outfits don't have the money. Larger ones don't have the bones. Apple may have set the standard for surprise unveilings, but accepting a major new product every few years, these mostly qualify as short-term. Google's modus operandi, in comparison, is gonzo AirDrops into deep, wait, really, territory. Last week, Apple announced a new iPhone. What did you do this week, Google? Oh, we founded a company that might one day defeat death itself." So it's an interesting proposition. We're not entirely sure what deliverables this new company, Calico, is going to have, how they're going to manifest their research. Google's keeping its information close to the vest, but expect it to use its core data handling skills to shed new light on familiar age-related maladies. Sources close to the project suggest it'll start small and focus entirely on researching new technologies. When will that lead to something Google might actually sell? It's anybody's guess. What do you guys think about this?
They're bringing back Walt Disney from Jungle Freeze.
Yeah, I'm excited about this only because I've seen, you know, we've seen other projects that have come out of the we've seen self-driving cars, we've seen Google Glass, Project Loon, these other sort of pie in the sky projects come out of Google that seem sort of outlandish, but have this enormous potential to change the world the way we operate in it. And I'm excited to see Google like put some money into this.
I think Google's also done a couple of things where you're kind of like, where'd that go? So I definitely want to. I think we should keep an eye on it. But just like when Glass started, there was a lot of hype, and the product is, you know, unremarkable, so to speak. You know, I'm wary of what's going on here. I do think that Google is focused on innovating. They don't want to be – they're still afraid of being the one-trick search pony.
Sure.
And they've got – frankly, they've got so much data on so many people. If they were to do something like acquire a company like Fitbit and begin to tie your physical activity to your online activity, that would really move the needle in terms of perception about what the company is. Now, they may not even need to do that, given the fact that so many of the new Android devices have access to people's motion. So that's like a thing. But I would say that Google wants to do what everybody else is doing and get into the health space, and why not, right?
Absolutely.
I really kind of look at it, and like I'll look at all of the failed or the non-money making successful projects that Google has done, like, you know, the cloud based, the service based stuff. It's great, but it's no, like, you know, search ad revenue.
Right.
It's not like they're trying to duplicate that and they can't. And I think that, you know, like, they're very successful in keeping people, you know, sticking around their product so that that search has a nice, like, burn rate of however long. But I think they're taking their money and their know-how and their innovation, and they're kind of being like, well, why do we have to stick to this industry?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can do it differently. Like, why don't we?
And Google's always been a jumper, right? They've always jumped in. For as many products as they've jumped into that don't work, they've jumped into plenty that have. They saw search in the beginning, and they revamped that. It's now the default. Their maps, again, the default. You look at the way they're doing their images, the auto enhance, all that stuff. I mean, it's a pretty Picasa, which is now just, you know, the Google Pictures and so on. That's a pretty compelling way to store your photos, especially when you look at, like, what's around. Like, that's free, like Flickr, right? And then you begin to look further into Google Plus, and it's, you know, its growth had some artificial bumps in the beginning, but it's being used and people enjoy it. So, you know, Google moving into this space that is quite trendy right now, so much so that Apple put a freaking, you know, motion sensor chip in their next device, and Samsung's made a watch dedicated to this, even though Garmin's been doing it for years. I think that it's a pretty clever move, and if they can focus, which is Google's biggest problem, I think, if they can focus, they can really get something out of that that's going to make their shareholders quite excited, and that's frankly going to make the consumer quite excited.
I think there's I would love to see what like I said, their deliverables, what comes out of this. And if in the long run it their efforts help extend our lives in general, I mean, how can you argue against that?
Mm-hmm. Really? It's certainly Elon Musk type it's Elon Musk type talk.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Except Elon Musk is Elon Musk. Like, if Google were to say, we're changing our CEO, we're getting somebody else in, I can't think of a better person than that guy, because he's, like, so future-focused.
But also, don't you see that all of these other companies, like, they riff off of each other. Like, I feel like Larry and Sergey kind of riff off of Elon, and Elon riffs off of them, and maybe they were all inspired initially by Bill Gates, his philanthropy. Like, I feel like they're challenging each other to become the better company, and not just the more profit making company, but the more.
It's legacy.
Yes,
it's legacy.
Yes. Yes, which I'm really excited about. I mean, when have you seen that in business, in the history of business? I think you had to get to this level of sort of...
Whenever Robert Barron died, they went crazy on legacy.
Right.
Rockefeller, Carnegie.
Right. When they died, yes, exactly. Exactly right. All right, moving on to our final story of the evening before we talk about our video of the week. And this one I felt was like an incredible example of the Netflix's... savvy with marketing. So Netflix sees itself as one of the most prominent competitors to the many pirate sites that offer video content without owners' permission. However, these pirate sites also offer Netflix valuable information as to what video content they should acquire for their service. And the company's vice president of content acquisition, Kelly Merriman, says that their offering is partly based on what shows do well on BitTorrent networks and other pirate sites. Kelly Merriman said, with the purchase of series, we look at what does well on piracy sites. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings adds that the company is aware of the many people who download content without permission via torrent sites. Certainly, there's some torrenting that goes on, he says, and that's true around the world, but some of that just creates the demand. One goal of Netflix is to convert people who currently use pirate sites to get their fix, and there's some evidence that this is indeed happening. According to Reed Hastings, there's evidence that BitTorrent traffic in Canada dropped 50% after Netflix started there 3 years ago. I think this is great. I mean, ultimately, like, the way I feel about online video piracy is that, yes, it's illegal. Yes, you may consider it immoral. But sometimes it's the only way to access that content at all, period. There is no other way. You cannot buy that content. So sometimes the only way to access it is through unauthorized channels. And so, you know, any effort that Netflix or any of these other companies make towards making it easier for you to legally get that content, I'm all for. And I love the fact that they're using the, you know, BitTorrent data on what people are downloading illegally to help enhance their offerings.
Looks at HBO.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, their whole thing is, I think Netflix said they have to become HBO before HBO becomes them. That's what the content officer said. And that's right. I don't think that the torrenting of stuff is justified, but I do think that it is a market indicator. If you can't find something somewhere, you can always find something somewhere. If you have to get a friend in Japan to ship you the latest anime, you could do that. Or you can get Crunchyroll or whatever. Services see this demand and they pop up. And I think there's, you know, as a person who spends a lot on digital entertainment, that's a thing that I've noticed. I can mm-hmm. find the stuff I want to find, except for Evangelion 2.0. I really can't find that. But when it comes to what Netflix is doing, they've proven that they're a data company. They're data-driven in many, many ways, and why wouldn't they expose themselves or exploit that kind of data? You know, amen to that. It's important for them to see what people want and to chase that down. So, you know, it's the way to go.
We're going to take one last break, and when we come back, our drill-down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world. There's nothing to it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas, Tosin Adafawakin, and Tom Cheridar. So, for our final story here, our Drill Down video of the week, Dwayne, you linked this to me. I saw this earlier in the week. I was just quite moved by this. This is the latest bit of viral marketing from, of all people, Chipotle, the Mexican quote-unquote fast food. I hate to put the term fast food because that's exactly sort of the image that they're trying to disassociate from.
I hate to put the term Mexican.
Yes. But why don't you describe this video for us?
Well, it's just a good example of magnetic content. Chipotle has an app, whatever, but they're here and they're like, hey, we want to get your attention. We want to draw attention to the fact that we like to think of ourselves as a provider of a more wholesome product than mm-hmm. perhaps some of the people that we compete with for your dollar, for your quick service restaurant stuff. And because of that, we've created a relatively immersive experience that's going to show you
a 3.5-minute animated video. And this isn't the first time that Chipotle's done this. They did this previously about a couple of years ago, maybe a year ago, with a short video that featured a cover of Coldplay's The Scientist sung by, of all people, Willie Nelson. It was a stop-motion video. This latest video is a 3.5-minute video featuring a scarecrow who is working for a fast food company run by robotic crows, and he's distressed at the state of the industry that he's working with, and his wish is to provide fresh food, wholesome food, organically sourced food to his customers. There's hardly a mention of the Chipotle brand except for the very end. And what's amazing about this is it's such a beautiful looking video. The soundtrack to this video is a rendition of Pure Imagination, the song from Willy Wonka the Chocolate Factory, sung by Fiona Apple. It's such a haunting rendition too. And the animation is done by Moonbot Studios, who had previously done a short movie called The Fantastic Flying Books of Morris Lesmore, which is based on a William Joyce story. And they have a very distinctive style. And I almost recognized this immediately when I saw the Chipotle video, because it's in that same Moonbot Studios style. And they also have an accompanying, as Dwayne had mentioned, an accompanying app for the for iOS, that's a game essentially where you can lead the scarecrow through different levels. And I think if you win this, all the levels of this app, you get a voucher for a free burrito at Chipotle.
So there is an ends to the means.
Yes.
I will. So as far as that the video goes, I think it's really nice and remarkable when, you know, companies try and do more than just, you know, advertise their product, when they try and say a little bit more about maybe the world that we live in and how they're going to bring about change. Not necessarily, you know, they could have gone with very simplistic, you know, what you've seen from all other sort of fast food restaurants out there.
But McDonald's is putting out an app that's like a shark mouth, right? Like, you put it in front of your face and you talk, and it just makes it like it's talking for you. And that's right. The app that they put out. This is what Chipotle is doing. They're trying to make you think.
Right. It's a commentary on it's a sort of meta commentary on their business in general, which is interesting.
What's really interesting is how it's focused on a certain serenity. Everything about it is serene. Everything about it is about contemplating this very important thing, this very intimate thing, what goes into your body. And as they sit there, and they're like Andy, you said, they're trying to get out of this idea of fast food. And they're doing that by saying, we offer a higher quality product. We offer it such a high quality product. We want you to see what we experience and what we compete with when you're looking at our so-called competitors in McDonald's and so on and so forth. They're saying, this is what you're getting from the other guys, and this is what you're getting from us. Natural. Respectful, right. Sustainable, and we're not only going to tell you that, we're going to show you that by having you play this game, which exposes that in detail. And that's where the magnetic part of what they're doing really comes into play. This idea that you're immersed in their experience, and you're doing it in a way that's fun, interesting, and engaging. So there's something there. There's there.
Anyway, we're going to have the video. And the link to an article about the animators behind the video in the show notes, so feel free to check that out. I think that wraps it up for this show tonight. I want to thank Tom Cheridar for his participation tonight. We missed you, Tom. Tell us where we can find your work on the internet when you're not here on guesting on the show.
You can find me over at venturebeat.com, and I'm all over the place over there.
Tosin, where can we find your work online when you're not here on the show?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, T-O-A-S-T, 4321. And you can also find my other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me on twitter.com/DwayneD. That's D-W-A-Y-N-E-D. You can also find me on Google+. That's gplus.to/DwayneD. And you can find everything I do at flavors.me/DwayneD. I mean, that's everything I do. They're like pictures up there.
As for myself, you can find my work at MrBabyMan.com. Also Twitter.com and Facebook.com, MrBabyMan. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on The Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let our podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. Be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world? There's nothing to it. There is no life I know to compare with pure imagination living there. You'll be free if you truly